I led a guild in World of Warcraft for years in college. And at that time, you would like start casting a spell, and then you'd have like 2 seconds till the spell went off, right? And so for years, I was spending a lot of time typing in an environment where I had to deliver complete thoughts to people in under 2 seconds. Scotch. Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 309 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast, Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam, and I'm inside out when I look at mirrors.
I'm Sam, and I'm a man.
And this is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. Today is April 29th, 2021. Dunk on everyone. Before we get started, we have a warning. There's going to be profanity in this show. And we'd also like to thank our supporters over at moneygrab.bscotch.net. We got a message from Min Kaizen, who said, "Been listening to your podcast for a while now and bought both Crashlands and Levelhead, but haven't had time to play either."
Nice.
So I thought I'd give you guys a coffee instead. Also, I'm really liking Adam's dev chat. Please continue to write about whatever you want.
That's the only possible thing that will ever be in there, so that's perfect.
So I like that this person was like, "I've given money for two games and haven't gotten anything out of them. So I'm going to throw some more money at this studio just to really, I'll take it, lock it in." And we also, of course, have recurring supporters who are donating monthly, and we appreciate that as well. Let's talk about life, you guys. Let's talk about agua. Let's talk about water.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. So I was on a trip this past week. Saw my
what kind of trip we talking? Are we talking a trip? Like, were you tripping?
I was not tripping. Unfortunately, No, this is just like a standard traveling trip to go see my wife's family. And at one point, this series of things happened that I thought both that Adam said that you guys could relate to way too hard, probably, and then our listeners would find probably very amusing. So. Here's the shtick. Mm-hmm. My wife had one of her classes going on, so she's sitting there in a hotel bed with doing like the laptop screen sharing stuff, right? And I'm reading a book, and I'm deeply engaged with this book, and it's like probably seven or eight p.m. So Adderall's like not affecting me at all.
Just tapered off.
This is just regular Sam, right? And so I'm reading this book, and I'm like deep. In this book. And my wife says, "Hey, could you grab me some water before you got to talk in this class?" And I was like, "Sure." Get up, go to the bathroom, walk into the bathroom.
Are you still holding your book?
Oh, no. No, I left the book. Get into the bathroom and I stand there for a moment.
I already know what's
with. Because I'm in the bathroom now and I'm like, why am I here? So I vaguely remember that I was supposed to get water. So I get water. But then I just drink it.
You're like, this. I guess this is mine.
And I was like,
this has been my idea.
I guess I was thirsty. And then I fill it up again because I got to have some more water for when I get back. So I fill it up and then I come out with this cup and just sit down in front of my wife back at the table with my book.
Just chugging water.
Take a big sip of this water and go, and then just start reading my book again.
Oh, yeah. This water's so fucking good.
And she's like,
you should go get yourself some.
Excuse me. And I was like, oh, now here's the kicker. The book I was reading was on ADHD. So yeah, that was.
So was she just looking at you like, "What the fuck?"
Yeah, she's like, "What is this? The rudest way."
And of course, you're just chilling. You're just vibing. You got no clue.
I'm like, I got water. I don't know why I have water.
I'm so glad I picked up this water.
This is great.
I was thirsty. I don't know why I grabbed it to begin with, but it turned out that I was
so
thirsty.
Refreshing. Yeah. So that happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As soon as you said I went into the bathroom, I was like, I know what's going to happen. It's the your brain is because you're reading. You're thinking about something else.
Yep.
As soon as you pass a threshold of a doorway. Your brain is like, well, whatever happened in there stays in there, you know? So here we are now. Let's evaluate this new situation that we find ourselves in.
You remember the mission, but not the context, right?
Yep. Yeah. So then you're trying to reverse engineer why you are there. Mm-hmm. And you're just evaluating your context clues. You're like, well, I guess I'm sort of thirsty.
Yeah, I must be thirsty.
That must be why I came here.
A few weeks ago, Sampada showed us a picture because she was laughing hysterically of a kitchen sink at Seth and Sampada's household, which had in it a bottle of ketchup.
Yep.
And, and it was it's because the ADHD brain, you just have things and you put them places. It just happens. It's just a thing that happens, right? And your brain doesn't pay that much attention to which thing it is that you're putting somewhere. It's the same deal. It's like you got triggers, right? You put stuff away. So it always does, or not always. It often does that. Often does not. Also, and Seth was like at a mad scramble to make and eat some food, including adding ketchup to a thing. And so somehow the ketchup just ended up just in the sink.
It's a dish now.
It's a dish now.
I put some dishes in the sink. I was in putting stuff away mode. I had ketchup, but I was thinking about three other things, you know. And so the ketchup went away too. I've put a full Tupperware of scrambled eggs in the cabinet. But to be fair, it was with the other Tupperware. So like it was the right kind of That's container.
True. I have an even right more place. Horrifying one of these that nearly happened to me about 2 months ago. Which is I walked downstairs and I was holding a piece of trash in one hand and also needed to pee. Okay. I walk over to the trash can and then start like preparing to pee. And I was like, whoa, this is like, usually it would be the other way where you walk over the toilet and throw the trash in there. I've done that before. Like that's been a thing I've done. But I was like, this is the, like, come on, get with the program.
Oh man.
This is life. This is just don't what
you
it feel is. Like?
Because I've been on the ADHD drugs, and it does help, you know. But it doesn't it doesn't get you all the way.
God no, absolutely
off of this train. It's a wild ride. It's a wild train to be on. Stuff's just kind of happening. You know?
Stuff is just happening. Yes.
I just got something I was very excited about, which is. Something that I feel like you can only be excited about in very certain like times in your life, which is I got one of those Sunday through Saturday pill holders.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, we're hearing about like, hey, like all these people who with depression, a lot of them have vitamin D deficiency, right? And it's like maybe there's a connection, but it doesn't hurt to take it. So fuck it. I'm taking some. Mm-hmm. So going to take that every day. Got my multivitamin. I've got my Ritalin dosage. Got my melatonin. You know, and it's like, okay, I got a pharmacy going. And there have been so many times where like my Ritalin wears off. I'm now in full-on ADHD mode, right? I go take the next dose.
But then you can't remember.
And then, then 10 minutes later, I don't remember whether I took it. And then I'm like, well, I don't want to take a double dose if I did, because that's going to be a problem. So I'm just going to ride this out and hope for the best. But, you know, if I parcel it out day by day, then it helps me reverse engineer stuff.
Honestly, right? Yeah. I mean, I had those pill boxes. If you remember, it was a 4x7 because of when I was on the cancer drugs, because you had to take them morning.
Yeah, there are a lot of pills you had to take, and that's.
Yeah. And a 4x7 was like four. It was a grid of pill boxes. Yep. But I don't know how you keep track of that shit. Like, as soon as you're up to that many things per day, like.
You gotta have one of those things.
Yeah, I'm already at that case because I have morning and afternoon Ritalin. And then I have my evening. What's this other stuff called? The stuff for my. To help the nerves in my gut because they're all fucky and don't want to behave. Although it hasn't been helping yet, so who knows?
It's called like gut nerve kablam.
Gut nerve softener. It's like a stool softener, but not for the poop, just for the gut. You know what I mean? It's remembering. So I just have three alarms throughout the day. And of course, I'm always doing some other shit when I go off. So I'm just like hit the snooze button, you know, because like what's 15 minutes? But of course, for my afternoon Ritalin, if I hit that snooze button too many times, then we're talking like that's too late now, or it's going to be a bit of an adventure trying to get to sleep.
There was a time, and it wasn't that long ago. You know, there was a time when you would just like wake up and just start doing stuff. You just start doing stuff, and you know. You just kind of functioned.
I don't think I ever did. That's the truth.
You kind of functioned was the emphasis is the kind of part.
Kind of. But yeah, you know, it's I'm weirdly looking forward to like having more interesting concoctions to potions to add to my collection. Who knows what it's going to look like? So, anyways, I streamed Ludum Dare this past weekend.
Yeah, for a million hours.
So let's talk about it. Game jams, love them. They're always interesting. Ludum Dare is the worldwide game jam that it has two parts to it. You can either do the competition where you solo it, but you have to make everything from scratch, music, you know, all that stuff,
and open source it, right?
You have to open source it. It's very like, it's got a very particular set of rules, which for where I am just makes it not fun. So, cause like, I don't have a background in music composition, and I also don't have the tools. Right. And so like most of the time would be spent making a bad piece of music. Right. and nobody wants to hear that. So I'm totally comfortable with like, entering the jam part of it instead of the competition, which is they say you don't need to open source it. You can use external libraries, other stuff, as long as you have the license to do it. And it's not, you know, you're not committing intellectual property theft or anything. So I ended up streaming in like 2 hour segments throughout the whole weekend with at least like an hour break in between. And I did, I think 14 and a half total hours of streaming. It was, and I only worked on the game during stream. Actually, the only thing I did off stream was add music to it because I don't think anybody wanted to see me like trolling through a free music archive, hitting play on 50 different songs. Because that's not good streaming content. Let's be real. Mm-mm. It was pretty fun, I gotta say.
How did you manage to do, given that you're streaming the whole time? Because you talk about how much harder streaming is to actually like produce something while you're streaming.
Truthfully. Well, I oriented my plan around the fact that I was streaming. And so I said like, okay, I've got 14 and a half hours to make this game. But I need to make a game that I would probably normally be able to make in 6 hours.
Right.
Right. Because most of the time on the stream, I will be explaining stuff. I'll be moving at a slower pace. I will be answering questions. Because I think that people coming into Twitch streams, they don't just want to watch some person silently doing stuff that they don't understand, right? Yeah. They're there to engage, and I think that's the reason you do stream is to have conversations and like talk to people about stuff, right? That's why you do it live and not just record a YouTube video and then put it up. So it was hugely challenging, I think, to bounce back and forth between like programming game systems and then talking in the chat and everything. But the game that I ended up making turned out pretty fun. It's called Space Demons, Demons with a Z, because it's in space.
It's hip.
It's a pretty straightforward space shooter. But somebody in the chat suggested a way to upgrade your ship that has drawbacks. Okay, so that was kind of like the core driving force behind it. So you clear out a wave of enemies, and then I set up a system so that it would sort of mix and match and scramble positive and negative effects, and it would always present you with three options, right? Mm-hmm. So it'd be like, your ship is smaller, which of course makes it harder to hit, but like enemies now shoot faster, or you have better better turn speed, but your firing rate has gone down. Generally, the way people would play it, I think, is they pick a thing to try to optimize toward, right? And they'll pick that thing kind of regardless of the drawbacks, mm-hmm. unless the drawback is too bad. Mm-hmm. So people were posting a bunch of hilarious screenshots because one of the I made it so that everything scales up or down infinitely, but it scales down in sort of a Zeno's Paradox way because it's percentage based. So it's like maybe like your size is reduced by 20%, but you can do that as many times as you want, but it's multiplicative, right? So you'll never hit zero and you'll never go below zero.
But you will get very, very small.
You'll get very small and very hard to hit. And there's asteroids, which also can grow or shrink depending on drawbacks, and so can the enemies, right? So, So somebody was optimizing toward having the largest enemies possible so that they could just wildly fire in any direction and always hit a giant enemy. And yeah, they got enemies that were like the size of the whole screen. So
that's really cool.
Yeah, and also like I put in 5 difficulty levels, which really is just like how fast things happen in the game. It's like a game speed thing. So yeah, it was a nice exercise in making a simple but fun game that had a lot of weird replay value and loops in it. It kind of reminded me of back in the day when we did like our 8-hour jams in the studio when we made stuff like Flop Rocket and things like that. So I'll probably be putting those up on YouTube for anybody who's interested in seeing it. But just bear in mind that it's like 40% development, 60% philosophical bloviating. Mm-hmm. So
it was very funny, though. I popped into the stream just kind of periodically, but in particular that first Friday night. There's some good one-liners in there that I think you could make into sort of a Confucius-style book. I can't remember any of them offhand, but there were a few that I just actually made me cackle.
I think one that Adam quoted back to me was when I was making a Starscape, and I had I used the paint spray paint tool in Inkscape to like just blast a bunch of stars all over the place. And I was like, I don't know if this is how you do it, but this is how the Big Bang did it. So if it's good enough for physics, it's good enough for me. I had some rum and coke that first night. Don't lose the things up. We'll have more information if those end up being up on YouTube.
If you just go to subscribe to the YouTube channel, like the only stuff we're putting out there basically for the foreseeable future is going to be random technical videos and streams and things. So if you're into that, you'll be into the rest probably anyway. So you might as well just go over there and subscribe to it. I did also reorganize our channel a little bit in the playlists and stuff to kind of consolidate and make it a little easier to find stuff. So if you are into that kind of content, there's also a backlog there that maybe you haven't seen.
Get in there. All right, let's get on to some questions. These questioners come from our website over at podcast.bscotch.net. Highest upvoted question is actually 2 questions that are sort of related.
Hacks or worse. Okay. Wait, 2 separate questions or 1 question that snuck 2 in there?
It's 2 separate questions from 2 separate people. Ah, okay. The people are Gear Whip Toppy Beep and El Yip Nip Mappa.
Okay. What a duo. What a legendary duo we have
today. And basically the gist of the questions is, hey, do you guys have any other good podcast recommendations?
You know how time is a circle? Or whatever. So I only say this because weirdly recently, a whole bunch of things have been happening that I know for a fact happened about a year and a half ago because I'm listening to our podcast backlog, right? So all back to back, and I can't remember even all the things, but the 2 things that are sticking out in my mind right now were that at that time, Seth was streaming again. Mm-hmm. And it was only for like a few week period, right? But he was like streaming. So like we were talking about that a whole bunch. And then also – one of the episodes, somebody asked us about what podcast we listened to. And so we just talked through all the podcasts. Now, here we are again.
We're back.
1.5 years later, just talking about the same things.
Well, I'll just throw out a couple. This American Life, super, super interesting. Just interesting stories. Radio Lab. They just talk about weird crap. They just pick a weird – they just pick a thing and they're like, let's go real deep into this. They even have a 6-part series on gonads. Just
on gonads.
On topic for the gonads, which is there's a book called Fallacy, but spelled like phallus, mm-hmm. like a pH, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. It's written by I think she's a biologist of some sort, but it's just this smart ass, hilarious thing about sort of like. Like the biological history of the penis as an entity, right? Focusing on biologists' obsession with it because and so there's all this like really good commentary about like the social bullshit and she pulls no punches with things like evolutionary psychology, which is like 100% bullshit, you know, and it is very funny. Although it does, I gotta say, I discovered very quickly that I do not care about the biology. The evolutionary biology of that particular organ. I've started to get bored, even though it's biology by a very smart, smart-ass person. That part started to be less interesting. But still, even just like the intro alone is worth the price of entry. It's very funny.
There you go. If you want to learn about gonads.
If you want to learn about gonads, listen to that American Life thing and then go read this book.
Radiolab is gonads.
Radiolab is
gonads. Yeah, I listened to this one called The Cut recently. I've been listening to a lot of it's really good. I like the woman's vibe and voice, the host of it. And it was one of my favorite ones was on kindness. And they had Jonathan Van Ness, who's the
hairstylist from Queer Eye.
Yes, from Queer Eye. And it was about like, what does it mean? What's kindness for? What is it? And like, is it good to be kind, you know? Or is it really just somehow not good? And so
– kill someone with kindness?
Can you kill a man? Yeah. It's a very fascinating show that I think they actually give you nuance, which is what I like. Mm. They never just say like, no, kindness is terrible. They might get there at some point in the episode, but then they always sort of, you know, basically come around
kindness to
the
point that like – terrible.
It's all about – yeah, it's all nuance. So they do a really good job of that. So I like that one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I still listen to a lot of syntax.fm. It's my main podcast because it's like – up-to-date stuff about web dev. So I get to learn about new cool things that are coming out. They still talk a lot about React because that's what web developers care about. And I just cannot give a single shit about React. So that's a little annoying. But it's still a lot more stuff than just that. But it's very well done. And the two people who co-host it, their whole jobs, there's like self-created little empires they've made for themselves, are selling courses about web dev. So their whole job is to go try out new technologies and build courses around them, right? So
that's pretty cool.
So smart people who know how to like explain things to a really wide array of audiences who've also kind of experienced everything. So that's a good one if you're into web dev. And the other one I've been listening to a bunch lately is called Darknet Diaries, which is a cybersecurity podcast. But they talk about – they basically tell some story of cybersecurity, you know, threat or issue or thing that happened, and kind of just dig into it. And the stories are just wild. And so like, they'll bring in like professional penetration testers, you know, people who go like physically try to get into buildings and stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And like listen to their stories. And so some of the people they bring on are people who were doing this before that was recognized as a field, which was a very scary time to be doing it because it was hard to explain when you got caught, right? What you were up to.
And, they're paying me to do this, I swear. Yeah.
But they did that kind of stories because like, they all have, you know, of course, wild stories of how they got into a bank, how they got into a whatever. And it's largely social engineering plus like fun, interesting little surprises, you know. And so it's super fascinating. I think my favorite sort of little tiny tidbit from one of them was that they couldn't get into a building that they wanted to get into, but they found that they could like – that the door – there was like a gap in the door. Or like somewhere there was a gap they had access to. And so they put some malware on a thumb drive and just threw it in, just like popped it through the door because they were like – it was a big company. Like somebody's going to try to figure out what's on this, right?
Did it work?
And then it worked. Like this kind of stuff just worked. And then a lot of it is just so much they just like – yeah, if you just are talking on a phone when you walk into a building, like nobody stops you, you know? And so, like, if you just like get a clipboard, start working through. They talked to this woman who was really hilarious, and she had a fake cast on, and the whole thing. So she made this big production, like coming up to a door and like trying and just like put her thumb on it because it had a thumbprint, and of course it went red, you know. So nice. She was just like sort of cussing. She's like, "God damn," you know. She's trying, like, as if like there's just this aggravating thing that things are just going to hell right now, right? And then she drops all of her stuff, and so she's like trying to pick it up with one arm, and they're just making such a scene that the security guard just like rushes her through the door and then she like pulls off her fake cast and then like goes off and, you know, breaks into a thing. Like it's wild shit.
I mean, so you know what?
I recommend it.
Cause there's this heist movies, right? Like the Ocean's 11 movies or whatever. And it's always such an elaborate scheme for them to get in, but it's always about like coordinated guard shifts and like traps and locks and lasers and stuff, right?
Yeah. But and like, almost all of it with the professionals who are really doing it, they basically bring in whatever they can and then they just improvise all the way through because they don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah. And so much of it, though, is so simply down to just like being confident and just walking into it.
I would 100% watch a reality show that was of these people breaking into increasingly secure buildings. That would be – because it's not about being like – it's not about, you know, entering through a duct. It's like – you have to walk through the front door, right? Yeah. That's like the rule.
Yeah.
And then like however far you can get into the building to like get this top secret shit, whatever else, that would be amazing to watch. I would love
it. Yeah, the stories are very fun. So I'd recommend that one. They also it's not just that it's like it covers like every kind of cybersecurity topics. They talk about like the hack at the Olympics, like I think it was the Winter Olympics in Korea, and then there was a huge hack that brought down everything, like the night that it all started. And so they talk first about the whole like what happened as people try to get it fixed, right? They spent all night like how they pulled that off and like what the virus was doing, and then the next years were all these different researchers and companies all over the place trying to figure out who the fuck did it, right? And they were like digging into the anatomy of this malware, and then it turned out it was designed in such a way to hide its origin by taking like pieces of code from all kinds of other countries, like of other countries, state-based hacking groups, and then editing them a bit and then putting them in there, and, like putting snippets of comments that they quote unquote left in there on accident, right, in different languages and stuff, and so that like they did all this stuff to obfuscate where it was coming from, but they did it in such a way that it also kind of hinted at somebody who was doing it, which turned out to be a misdirect, right? It's like, and which people eventually pieced together. It's fucking wild. So yeah. Anyway, very fun stories.
So the person who made it was like, how would this other person or organization
they try to obfuscate the whole chain?
Right.
Yeah.
That's cool. Yeah. I'll say one last thing about podcasts, which is something really interesting happened, which is, do you guys know the podcast Reply All?
Yes.
I've heard of it. Yes.
Did you hear about what happened with their kitchen episode? So they started putting together a series about test kitchens, which is like the for some of these like food magazines where they develop recipes and stuff. Okay, and the series was supposed to be an expose about how badly people of certain groups were being treated in these.
Oh, probably triggered from the Bon Appetit.
Yeah, from the teeth thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they were doing a series about this, and they released the first episode, and I was like, oh, that's interesting. That was an interesting episode. We'll see what happens next. And the next episode they released was like 1 minute long, which was one of the hosts saying, we're not going to continue this series. And also the people who put the series together have resigned because it turns out that they have been responsible for creating a similar work environment for some of the people in our company. Mm-hmm. And all these complaints emerged as soon as they aired the episode.
What?
And they're like, we don't really know when we're going to be back on the air. We don't really know what's happening.
Because it was the main two guys, right?
One of them.
One of the two?
Yeah. Yeah. And so – It was what a roller coaster that was. Because wow. I would be listening to that podcast for quite some time. They had some really interesting content on there. But it was weird. All of a sudden, like a 1 minute apology episode, and like, yeah, things are really weird right now. And then that was it.
That's hilariously, I don't even know the right word, it's like myopic or something like that, that they would be doing an expose on behaviors that they were also participating in.
Yeah.
That meant that they had to know that that was a problem, but also not be aware somehow that they were also doing it or something.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know.
Bizarre.
I don't know. It was weird, but that was kind of a bummer. You know, it kind of sucks when – because it's a very entertaining podcast, and they had all kinds of interesting stories, mostly focused around like web stuff, and they would do these really deep sort of investigative dives into strange things, you know. But to kind of hear them like that behind the scenes, there's this kind of really shitty thing going on. I don't know. It's a bummer.
Yeah. Sometimes the stories surface about how the thing that you liked was made, and you realize there's like a lot of suffering involved.
Yeah. It was made by grinding up souls.
Yeah. And you're like, oh, that's.
Yeah. Like, which almost every video game that you love was probably made from the souls.
Yeah. Or like every electronics product you bought or.
Yep.
Yeah. Everything that you've consumed, I guess. Yeah. Which. Whoopsie.
Whoopsie.
Anyway, let's go on to the next question. Amerchi Kuli Yuppa says, hey guys, big fan of your podcast. Recently watched one of Seth's programming videos on YouTube, and you type like a beast. Obviously one with pretty good dexterity, so I guess that was like a compliment. Not like a, you type like a person with dog paws. Kind of
thing. You type like a hoovernoid.
Any tips for getting from okay at touch typing to blazingly fast? Do you use IntelliSense at all with coding, or is it faster to just type? Any other thoughts on typing code Rafat? So,
Seth doesn't use much IntelliSense, but that's not by choice.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's because I use GameMaker.
It's because there isn't any good IntelliSense.
It's got some, but not a lot.
IntelliSense, for anybody who doesn't know, is basically your code editor knowing about the stuff that you're doing, like knowing about the programming language and what it can do, and knowing about the grammar of the language, and then knowing about the stuff that you've already typed, like all your variables and stuff, so that it can spot when things are wrong. It can autofill, or it can give you like a list of things that might be what you want to choose. So you can basically hit like a hotkey and I'll be like, oh, did you mean one of these? And you hit enter, and then the thing appears, right?
It's sort of like basically suggest or autocorrect typing, but like on
autocomplete.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I'm a pretty big believer in, and more so as time passes, is that most of what you see is the result of some kind of a structural thing that made it so. Okay. So I could say, like, here are some websites that you could go to like learn how to type faster or whatever. But the fact is, that's not how I did it. Mm-hmm. How I did it was I led a guild in World of Warcraft for years in college. And at that time, you would like start casting a spell, and then you'd have like 2 seconds till the spell went off, right? And you can type to your party members, and you can type in guild chat. You can type messages to people, right? And so for years, I was spending a lot of time typing in an environment where I had to deliver complete thoughts to people in under 2 seconds. and because I'm also a big believer in clarity and grammar and stuff, I never went with the bullshit of like using singular letters to replace words. I've never done that.
I think that's actually the key for me too. So I didn't have that experience, but I just have written a lot, just a lot. And I have also the whole time refused to do anything but like starts with a capital letter, ends with like the whole thing is always grammatically correct. And having to – because that just means you have to type a lot more just all the time. And so I think that definitely changes your approach to not trying to get it – because you're not trying to get it done as fast as possible, making the content as short as possible. You have to do it the other way around now. You have to just be able to move your fingers as fast as possible.
Yeah. So I think nowadays I can type at a decent like 115 words per minute with like 98% accuracy. But there's a downside to that too, which is that being able to type that fast on a keyboard makes using a touchscreen absolutely infuriating. Right? Because like if you're typing at 50 words per minute and then you go down to 20 on a touchscreen, it's like, well, it's a little bit less than half, but you know, it's like it's not that huge of a downgrade. But if you're now typing at like 16% of your normal speed on a touchscreen, it just feels like, what's even the point? So, for real. Like I've so many times looked into like, should I get a foldy keyboard that's like a Bluetooth keyboard that I can just like pop open whenever I want to do email or text stuff on my phone, you know? I've looked into so many things like that, but they all kind of suck.
Maybe you should just do voice. Just do dictation.
Mm-hmm. That might be the move I could try. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I think – and again, structural stuff, right? Like because of that, I just really don't like it when people text me. Like no matter what it is, because the quickest way to respond to a text is through a touchscreen interface, or I could like go to the messages website, you know, and like scan a QR code to pull up my messages app and then type responses through that. But like, don't text me.
Yeah, I think most of my text messages from Seth are just the words, just the letters okay.
Yeah. Yeah. If you want more info from me, you know, let's go to email where I can really get ideas across in a timely manner. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I mean it's I guess if I were to kind of loop back around, if you want to type faster, put yourself in scenarios that require you to type fast. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, and you can do that through like games or through keyboard racing, like at keyboard.com.
There are typing games now.
Yeah, there's some great typing games.
Incredible ones. And I'm pretty sure you could like turn that shit up to 11. That'd be a lot of fun.
Yeah, when you force yourself into a scenario, but you have to do it a lot. It's like requires a lot of practice. If you can find a way to practice a lot at both speed and accuracy under under pressure that forces those two things. And then just do that as a, when I say as a habit, I mean, you know, construct your daily routine such that you can slot that in there.
Yeah. I would say the most important thing is actually the accuracy part, because doubling back will slow you down so much more than your speed forward could ever go. So like it's
only focus on accuracy. Yep.
So if there's something that you can tell, if you use like, you can try like Keeber or something like that and just see where there's something where if you obviously are just making errors with like hitting the period button or something like that, just all the fucking time, then literally just focus on that, because improving even one of those things oftentimes will like just like massively boost your overall speed up.
It cascades.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Cause there's going to be some kind of a bottleneck. That's like your weakest point, you know, always focus on those bottlenecks. So
maybe Seth, maybe on one of these streams you should do is just to challenge the community to typing races.
Ooh. Yeah.
Ooh. I can only probably do that for like a half hour. Cause
oh yeah, then your arms would be dead. But
yeah, typing at that speed for that amount of time, like you're.
It's like the Flash. You need little armor pieces for your fingers. You know.
Yeah, I'll be chugging Gatorades. Or I'll just like, I'll just hold up my hands and dump Gatorade on them. You know.
Yeah.
I need more mana. All right. Next question comes from Zeflat Duervier, who says, how do you share and store game assets so everyone can access them? Do you use version control for any assets other than code? So we don't store them so that people can access them. We store them so that robots can access them.
Correct. So all our pipe – we basically have a pipeline from Clip Studio Paint into the game. Just sort of shoves them in there. And – the way we do that is, so as far as like accessibility, you'd have to have an actual, you'd have to have Clip Studio to get to the actual files themselves. All of those files are just one big place. And then they all get, any exports go into a particular folder that is watched by a robot. You know, we love these robots. They're doing stuff for us. So
I love robots.
This robot watches stuff that comes in there and then it reads the name and there's little additional sort of signifiers on the end of the name, like --NC. For example, which means don't crop this robot. Don't you fucking dare. Don't touch it. And so at that point, the robot would be like, I'm not going to crop this. I'll just send it along into what we call basically the production asset folder.
Yeah, otherwise it'll auto crop and auto bleed the hard assets as they come out.
And so it flies in there and then I can look at it. I use VS Code to actually check all the art assets. So I just have VS Code open. Can see it in there and I could say, this looks correct, or this has like some weird artifacting I didn't notice, whatever else, just to kind of eyeball it. And then there's a separate script, another robot that you use on your local machine that imports the art. So it looks in that folder of all the production assets, grabs all of them, shoves them, injects them into GameMaker. And then GameMaker has to do like a little refresh because it's like, when you just do that to it, it doesn't really like it that much. So shove all those in there. And then it, with some very intense magic from Adam's side of things, essentially stitches all of that together so that the game puts the right things in the right place. So any updates you made on an existing asset in the right spot.
And those imports do get baked into the version when it gets kind of, you know, frozen as part of the versioning system. So the final version. So the source, so unlike in code where the source itself is being very carefully versioned, the source for the art, which is then the content of these save files from Clip Studio Paint or in the past from Inkscape or whatever, those are not versioned in the same kind of way, but they are made and stored. We just store them in Dropbox because Dropbox has versioning, right? Mm-hmm. So they'll store some X number of versions and they'll archive things over time. And so there's a limited amount that you can't as easily – you can't say like, okay, well, for this version of the game, I want to go back and find the source that was at that same version. We can't really do that. But most of what we do for those assets is moving forward, right?
Yeah.
Because the question you always have to ask when you're dealing with like a versioning system is, what is this for, right? What are we going to do with this thing? Because the goal isn't to be able to go back to any point in time and recover everything necessarily, right? That's what a lot of versioning systems like are designed to be able to do, but they're mostly for collaboration and ensuring that everybody has the same content and ensuring that we know when content is new or that we can compare changes to make sure that if two people change the same thing, we don't, you know, that something doesn't go wrong.
Or if the game starts crashing, you can be like, what changed?
Let's probably look there at what changed.
Yes, exactly. Art just is a different sort of thing, right? Because it doesn't
crash the game.
Yeah.
I think it's the same thing. It's just that it's versioning it as harder because it's really hard to version image data, right? Like compared to versions of a save file for Clip Studio Paint, like what does that even mean, right? You could look at it, but that's the best you can do, right? And so the whole idea of versioning kind of just doesn't really, or you can't get as much value out of it.
Yeah.
But again, you're staying on the bleeding edge. And so while Sam is working on a thing, he's basically making a smaller number of sort of version saves of that thing, like basically in the present to a little bit in the past. And then we have things, you know, again, because of Hangout Dropbox, we have like probably that file from a year ago too or whatever. And so if he does a whole bunch of work and is like, oh no, this is like, I went down a bad path here, right? Then in many cases, he would be able to, if he really needed to, get back to a version he could start from, right? Which is another big reason for version control.
Yeah. And I think I do that. I assume a lot of artists do too. So if I go in, I'm like, oh, I'm going to go, you know, change the character or whatever else. I don't just fucking nuke. Like, you just copy paste the current folder.
Yeah. You just duplicate the character.
Just like hide it. And it's so essentially you have sort of a non-structured kind of miniaturized version of source control inside of your files themselves.
Yeah, it's not like code where you have to change what is there in order to make it work differently, right? With art, you can dupe it and just play around with it and be like, never mind, and then delete the new thing and stick with the old thing or whatever. So yeah, it's flexible in that way. But yeah, so we do the same thing with audio, which is we work with, for example, Fat Bard. We have a Google Drive folder that they just put whatever exported sounds into that are ready to be brought into the game. And then we just have an automated system that just pulls those sounds right in and processes them and makes us aware that they are new and all of that stuff. And if you're interested in using this pipeline, we have the import side of the pipeline available on GitHub. It's called Stitch.
The export side is there too.
For Clip Studio?
Yeah, Sprightly. Sprightly is what Sam is using to do it. So actually they're both up there.
So if you want the art export side as well as the game, so Stitch can be used to import sprites, audio files, or you can just straight up import stuff from one GameMaker project into another GameMaker project. So
any resources you want.
So definitely if you're using GameMaker in any kind of a capacity to develop projects that are long-standing projects, check out Stitch on our GitHub page because it's nice. It is really nice to have. Okay, let's get to one last question. So it's kind of a long question. It's from Woland77. So I will summarize it by saying, what are your attitudes toward using crowdfunding for B-Scotch projects?
So specifically for our own projects.
Well, my attitude toward crowdfunding in general, though, so that there's probably no difference, is that if it makes sense for you to do, fucking awesome.
Do it.
Do the
shit. Get that dough.
I think people massively underestimate the amount of additional work that they get out of doing a crowdfunding campaign.
I think you need to assume that a crowdfunding campaign on average is a net loss.
Yeah. Yeah, if you're shooting so
on average, that's true. Like almost
everything. No, it is. But the point being that crowdfunding is a misnomer, right? It should be called like a marketing launch or whatever, because like launches can fail, right? The thing is, even when you succeed at crowdfunding, that doesn't mean you came out ahead on any dimension, you know, because the cost of you being able to succeed in crowdfunding is very, very high. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I consider crowdfunding more of a marketing tool, because truthfully, even when we look at modest game budgets, the typical game ones that you see nowadays on Kickstarter is like $60,000 what people are asking for, because that's essentially people feel like usually you can hit that if you got a good enough concept. But I mean, realistically, that pays for if it's supposed to be funded by the crowd, it is not being funded almost in the slightest by the crowd, right? So I think. Most of the time, I would just say sort of high level, non-nuanced point. Most of the time, I would view something like a crowdfunding campaign as a marketing tool, not as a actual funding tool.
Yeah, but it is a very expensive marketing tool because it requires a lot of your time to put together. And so if you're time rich and money poor,
yes,
that was our case in early on in the life of Bscotch. We just didn't have any money, so we couldn't we couldn't use money to do marketing, and so we had to use time instead. And I think that's a place where these things are most advantageous, is getting from having no money to some money, but not enough that it like really pays for people. So I think if you're in a privileged enough position where you just don't need to pay people well because everybody can afford to not be paid well, right? Like a bunch of people starting the company together and taking a big risk and so on, then I think there are some mm-hmm. uses there, definitely.
Now, what about the crowdfunding approach of Star Citizen? This was Robert Space Industries, Star Citizen. It's going to be the game to end all games. It's going to have everything in it. It's going to have a first-person shooter. It's going to be like EVE Online. It's an MMO, but also it's like you can go to every planet and you can do whatever.
They won't have any women though in it, right? Is that – don't understand.
They didn't have any female character models, yeah. I think. For the first like 7 years. They might have them now. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, they'd only raise something like $500 million. So it would be.
That's like one of the most hilariously embarrassing facts.
It's just not in the budget.
It's more embarrassing how unembarrassed they were about it. Yeah, that's wild. You know, it's fucked up.
Yeah. So their crowdfunding model, which I think they called it crowdfunding, but it was basically just early access with shit tons of in-app purchases.
The truth is like – so part of the difficulty with crowdfunding is the ratcheting cost of someone who is doing – who's paying you in the crowdfunding context. So if someone buys a game from us, they just get the game, and distribution for that is handled the same way as everything else. But if you're in a situation where they actually like get a t-shirt and a mug or some shit and they live in Singapore, like you got a lot of stuff to figure out to make that happen. So actually doing it through IAP or through – like honestly, if you were going to do it, I would primarily try to do it through in-game goods because that's the easiest delivery mechanism for a video game studio.
Yeah, it costs you because you have a one-time development cost, and then distribution is effectively free, right? I think that's the main thing is when it comes to crowdfunding, the vast majority of mechanisms that are even a little bit successful in terms of overall money raised. Do so by having an incentive system, right? And an incentive system eats most of that money that you just pulled in, which is why it's at best a marketing exercise in the vast majority of cases. But further, you tend to make part of the incentive structure is promises that you make where you say, if you get this, we'll give you a Steam key or we'll give you a whatever, right? And if you're early on in development, or not even early on, if you're 6 months out from launch, there could be a publishing scenario or some other business partnership that would have been on the table you didn't know about yet, right? That now you've made a promise to like deliver Steam keys where all of a sudden you talk to Epic and Epic says, oh, we'll give you $100 million for an Epic exclusive, right? I mean, probably not that much, but it still could be a lot. And now all of a sudden you're like, fuck, I either have to really piss off a whole bunch of people that I made this commitment to, which might even be a legal problem. It's hard to say, right? Or I have to not take this money, right? And so this is actually my biggest reason to not go with. Like I said, it's those two things. It's one is I have a hard time believing the effort is worth the cost. I think just in most cases. But then that final piece where I think you can paint yourself into a corner.
Those early commitments.
Yeah, really challenging.
I mean, we felt this even in like the weirdest, like slightest way, which was when we launched Crashlands. Mm-hmm. We wanted to do a launch day discount or like a launch weekend discount.
And we did pre-orders. Yeah.
Well, that's the problem.
That was the problem.
And so we were like, oh, it'd be great if we could like help because we were getting the Steam pop-up for the weekend. You know, I was like, oh, it'd be great if we could like do something to like really, you know, prime the launch on Steam and get those numbers up. Launch weekend discount, great way to do that. Except, we had done pre-orders where people could buy Steam keys directly through Humble, I think. Mm-hmm. But at full price. And so what that would mean then would be, and not that many people pre-ordered it. You know, we're talking,
Maybe like 200 people or something.
Yeah, so it wasn't like thousands and thousands of people, but it was enough people that we were like, we can't really do this lunch week discount, because what that would mean then is that the people who supported us early would be losing, right? They'd be losing out on the discount. So what does that mean? So you know, if you think about crowdfunding, it's the same thing. Like Adam said, you might end up promising a platform delivery that you end up not wanting to deliver on because of some future business deal.
Or that just turns out to be a bad investment, because it's often the case that because you learn as you do other stuff too, right? So we've learned by distributing on so many platforms, which platforms are likely just to be a loss for us, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you know, you learn that by having done it, and you might have overlapping things going on. So you may learn something at some point, or just talk to the people in the industry who through whom you discover, like, oh shit, like if we actually invest what it will really cost to go to this platform or the service, and you know, take like 3 months of studio time and get it on there, it's just going to be a loss, right?
Yeah. But you promised
a few hundred people that you would do
people
it.
People gave you, right? Yeah. And you know, that's one of those sort of like cold business decisions where you have to just say, like, we have to just tell these people, sorry.
Yeah. And you see this happen on Kickstarter all the time, right? And where people have to walk back some promise that they made.
Yeah. Cause you got some new information. It turns out it was a bad idea. It was a bad promise.
or you're like at Shovel Knight, right? Which did really, really well. But had promised so many like additional post-launch features.
Yeah,
they spent 3 years, I think, fulfilling those promises. 5 years, I thought. Yeah, 5 years even.
Yeah,
and it was guaranteed not what they wanted to be doing with their time. And I can't remember if they actually said that explicitly or if it just like was implied by all of their external messaging. But they were just like, they're like, we made this promise, because they had a big Kickstarter too. So they were like a few hundred people who would be potentially pissed. Right. But it was a lot. And they were like, we're going to come hell or high water. We're going to fulfill these promises. And so they spent 5 years, whatever it was, doing that before they could then be like, okay, cool. Now we can go make the sequel or whatever.
Yeah. Go do the thing we wanted to do.
You know? So I think the general take then, I think from everything we've said, kind of explains what our stance is on it as Butterscotch, which is that I think we're in a position, thankfully now, where we have all the industry context that we would need to be able to not have to do a Kickstarter. And the reason I say have to is because of this, the potential for some lock-in, stuff like that, where it's like, oh, you know, shit, now we literally can't do this deal for coming to this new platform because we already announced for this other thing and are literally talking to that platform. You know, it's like all that stuff that gets kind of trickier on the business side once you've made some of those promises.
I mean, I would try to get a publisher to give us upfront money and then take a cut of downstream revenue. You know, I would take that over trying to run a community crowdfunded campaign. Because that's pure uncertainty.
Yeah, and you don't know if it's going to work, right?
And it's very high cost for your time and effort to do it. And the return is low because, again, you basically have to give away most of the things that people have put money in for. So I would absolutely go for just a publisher before I would do that.
Like I say, so crowdfunding has its perks, but it's definitely not without cost.
It's a good strategic tool. Definitely,
to have
you have to do it. It's just like all these things.
You gotta know what it's for. Yeah, you're not going to use it to fund your game. That's just not going to happen. So if you can find a way, so if you're careful with your promises that you make, and you do a really good job with the marketing materials, and you know that you're good at it, because if you can't make a good, if you won't be able to sell your game, you won't be able to sell your Kickstarter either, because it's exactly the same problem in both cases of getting people to care about the thing that you're making. But if you can. And you're trying to just get if you're trying to bring in more people who know about it and who care about it and get them in early and get that like initial rabid fan base going, and you do it pretty early on, you don't overpromise and overcommit. Like I think there is a reality you can put together where, combined with a little bit of luck, you do come out ahead. But I think in most cases that's the number of things that have to go right for it to be a net win are pretty dang expensive.
Quite a few. All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this week. We would like to thank our producers, Fat Bard and Jen Coster, for putting the podcast together. And thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord running. To get more involved in the Butterscotch community, you can just go to podcast.bscotch.net, where we have links to the Discord, a way for you to donate, and links to the podcast archives. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week.
Goodbye.
Bye.